This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Baby, I'm home.
Well, thank you so much, Parker, and welcome to Time Signatures. I'm your host, Jim Irvin. And today's guest is a former member of the 2004 IBC-winning Zach Harmon Band. This Baltimore County native now resides in the state of California. He has also been around the blues scene for quite a little while, to say the least. He has been a presenter at the annual International Blues Challenge held in Memphis, Tennessee. He has also been a performer at the Big Blues Bender in Las Vegas. And he's also performed on the legendary Rhythm and Blues Cruise and is open for the likes of George Thorogood, Johnny Winter, Buddy Guy, and Dick Dale, among others. He's toured around the world and is doing things a little differently these days as a solo act, building an even bigger following. Dennis Jones, I want to welcome you to Time Signatures, and how are you, sir?
Jim, I'm great, man. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Now, according to your website, you began playing your guitar at the age of 13. How did that come about?
At 13, actually, it was Christmas Day. I wanted a drum set. And my parents, we had a house, but it was, I think for privacy, they just couldn't fathom me having a big drum set. So they asked me what my second choice was. So I said guitar. So they got me they went to a place called like Two Guys or Tops. I don't know if anybody remembers that from the East Coast, but they used to sell these little Japanese Taisco guitars, I think I pronounced it correctly, with a little plastic amp. So I got that for my, I think it was my 13th birthday. Excuse me, 13th Christmas. I'm not talking about birthday. Birthday is a whole another issue, but yeah, for Christmas and that's when I just started tinkering around on it and for a few years, and I had an uncle who actually could play, and he came over one day and tuned it up for me and showed me a few things, and I got really excited, but that's how it all started on Christmas Day when I was 13 years old.
Fantastic. At what point in your life did you determine that you would pursue music as your career?
I think I knew when I was 15 years old, 16, when I played in my first band when I was 16, I knew that, that's what I wanted to do. It took me a long time to get to that point. I've only been playing, really full time for the last 13 years, but, I had different jobs and stuff before, but I always managed to go out and play. I spent time with the Bus Boys in the early 2000s with Brian O'Neill and the Bus Boys. I spent time with Zach Harmon, Mid-South Blues Review, and I had my own band and worked a full-time job at the same time. I did all of that.
Wow.
How I look back and just go, I have no idea how I did it all. But it's just a love for the music, for the craft. I still don't need much sleep, 5 or 6 hours a night. I mean, I was kind of built for this stuff. And I love touring, but yeah, man, that's really, where I am with this. It's just, I'm getting off the question a little bit, but I just love it. I just love the craft and can't think about doing anything else. I started touring earlier, but the situation has never lent themselves to something that was going to be long-term. I wanted something long-term. And, the bands that I started in the late 90s and even when I first got to L.A., I was just searching for this one thing. I had all these singers and a lot of them had LSD. And I know you know what that is, lead singer disease. So I decided to take some vocal lessons and see if I could pull it off myself. And I've been doing it ever since. I think 2003 was my first album, Falling Up. And I was still in the Bus Boys, and Brian O'Neill actually produced that album.
I want to flip the page just a little bit here and talk about 2004. You competed with the Zach Harmon Band at the International Blues Challenge, and you won it all in 2004. You got to tell me what that experience was like. And was that your first time to compete in that challenge?
That was the first time to compete in that challenge. It was it was amazing. We had Cora Coleman. I think that's Zach's goddaughter. And she ended up playing with Prince later on. I mean, we just had just a really, it reminds you of early Stax records. You know, I just started watching that Stax documentary, you know, where, you know, black and white musicians playing. It was all about the music. And we weren't even thinking about, of course, we weren't thinking about color at all. Music is just music. And, but we just had a band that was really, it was tight. We were really tight. I went in and I was quite cocky back then. You know, I mellowed out a bit, but I went in knowing we were going to win. And everybody in the band was like, Dennis, be quiet, man. You know, just don't say anything. And I was telling the other bands, we would go hang out with some of the other bands and we'd start drinking and joking. And I'm a big jokester. I love having fun with people. And I was like, man, you guys might as well just pack it up, man, because we're going to take this. And, you know, why don't you just leave now? And they were like, oh, man, you're a jerk. And I was like, no, man, I'm just having fun. I mean, really, it was a party from the time we got there till we left. And I don't mean with alcohol and drugs. I just meant with the spirit of so many bands there. The music was in the air. You're in Memphis, like the home of the blues. So yeah, I felt very confident. And when we were the judges were, you know, judging the bands, and they were saying who was number three, number four, number two, and it was like, it was just so, when we won, I just exploded. I think I jumped on Zach Harmon's back, and he took me piggybacked all the way up to the stage. It was really, I mean, really exciting. And I made some really good friends there, from the guys from the other bands, from hanging out with the judges. And it was just I can remember it like it was yesterday. It was a really, really good experience. And, you know, and I think we deserved it. We were really a good band. You know, other guys there were good. Other people, female, male, they were all good. But, you know, it was great to win that. And Zach went on to win more awards and to become, you know, on his own, you know, without the Mid-South Blues Review, to become, you know, a great artist in his own right. And, you know, I went on to do my thing. Cora went on to play with Prince and other people. So, you know, Doug Mugg, the bass player, has played with everybody. He lives in Nashville. I think he's still in Nashville. So it was just really a great group of great people at the right time, right place, and went there and kicked some butt down in Memphis.
Awesome. You know, you've opened for some incredibly talented musicians, including George Thorogood, Tinsley Ellis, and of course, the legendary Buddy Guy. I have to ask you, as you stand off to the side, once you've done your opening act and you're watching these legendary performers do their thing, talk about how that feels. Is there ever a moment where you have a pinch me moment when you're watching them perform?
I've been around this stuff for a long time. Even before I was opening for these great acts, I was going to shows. I'm the kind of musician that will support other musicians that come to town if I'm not playing. I know a lot of people don't think that's cool because it's like they're hanging out in the crowd, and I don't care. I just saw Mike Zito last Sunday. So it's like when I'm there, I kind of don't think about it until after it's over. I remember seeing like Johnny Winter, you know, when I was growing up, and he was a hero. It was Johnny Winter and Alvin Lee at the Meriwether Post Pavilion in Baltimore. It's probably no longer there. But I was so, as a kid, I was so blown away that I got home and didn't want to play guitar anymore. I was like, I can never be that good. And my brother being my older brother, if anybody has older brothers, you know what I mean? He slapped me upside the head and said, shut up and practice and just keep practicing. So I thank him for his abuse and his words. But no, I mean, yes, I have sat on the side of the stage and go, wow. You know, opening for Dick Dale was, you know, he was quite the character. If anybody's ever met Dick Dale, you know what I'm talking about. He was quite a character. So is Buddy. And I felt I got a little love after, because nobody, they never heard me before. But after I play and they say, hey, good job, we like what you did, that means more to me than anything. Johnny Winter heard me doing my sound check. And, you know, he had just got off the stuff and he was on like some placebo. And we just went in this trailer, sat down, And I was nervous for the first time. He was the only person I think I've ever been truly nervous around. And I was just like, you know, Johnny, man, thank you for everything. I love your music. And, Still Alive and Well is like, you know, one of my favorites. You know, I grew up, he's probably the reason I started playing blues rock. Johnny was just a big, and almost like Hendrix. He was incredible. I mean, trying to figure out what he was doing. But he said, hey, you know, was that dude you doing a sound check? I said, yeah. He goes, hey, you guys are good. So after that, and when Johnny Winter said I was good, it's like, I didn't really care what anybody else had to say, you know, because I just, and it didn't like go to my head in some like ego kind of way, but it just gave me more confidence to keep doing what I'm doing because, you know, he was highly respected as a blues man and as a, just a person. And he had his troubles and stuff he went through in his career, but you know, towards the end, I think he had come back almost to the Johnny we used to know. And it was just a really amazing, amazing experience to be around that. And also, I didn't really get to talk to Buddy Guy as much, but, you know, because everybody's always on Buddy. So it's just a bit much. And but no, and Tinsley Ellis was a gentleman. He really, he gave me a great compliment too. He's like, you know, says you're, I don't want to follow you anymore. It's like something like that. So it was really a cool thing. And we hung out and got to talk and got to know each other. So yeah, man, it was great. I enjoy that. I enjoy all those opening spots and all those lessons that I got from people, and the conversations they mean as much as listening to the music when you get to talk to those guys and have these conversations. Guitar Shorty was a really good friend of mine. We lost him last year, but he was, you know, we used to have lunch together and talk and just another great that unfortunately he didn't get the recognition he deserved, but Guitar Shorty to me is just as important as Buddy Guy, just as important as all those other guys that were out there doing it and played stellar to the end. So, that's kind of cool. That's how I feel about all that. You know, standing next to the stage was great for a lot of that and getting to meet these guys. It's incredible.
Well, you're watching and listening to Time Signatures. I'm your host, Jim Rubin. Along with me today is Dennis Jones. Dennis, we are having a conversation about your history, about your transformation in the blues, the stuff that you're doing as a front man. And I'm excited to hear about the future. I want to look back at your history for just a minute. It looks like you've hit some really big shows across the United States, and you've also done some extensive touring outside the U.S. Any favorite locations along the way for you?
I just love being in a different city every night playing for people that, especially people that have never heard the band before and get a chance to experience something different. Because, you know, there's lots of, I mean, the blues market is saturated with a lot of great bands and a lot of different styles of blues. And that's the thing I love about the blues. It's like, I mean, I play blues rock with funk and, you know, I got songs that are country vibe, reggae vibe. I just love good songs. The heart of everything I write is from the blues, no doubt, no doubt of that. But I want this music to continue to grow, and especially myself to continue to grow as a writer, performer. And there will never be another Howlin' Wolf, another Muddy Waters. And right. You can chase that all you want. And some guys do. You can chase it all you want, but or another Hendrix, you know. So it's great to have that on your sleeve, to have as an influence, but to want to be like them is just, I think, for me, it's not what I want. But speaking of great places to play, I've played across the U.S. and played for some great crowds. When I go to Europe, I think Poland is one of my favorite places. The Polish people are very, they're like New Yorkers. They love you or they don't. we sell out every time we go there, and I've made some friends there, and they really, I mean, they're singing the lyrics of my songs, and not everybody there knows English, and but they're really sincere. They're passionate about, that's the word, they're very passionate about their music and I think their life in general. I got to spend some time, you know, a day off there and hang out with some people there and go to their homes. And That's the most fun part about touring. If you have a time to really get to know the people, I love to learn more about cultures. I'll even try my lazy English way of learning some of the language to, you know, because I think people will accept you more if you just try. You know, the lazy and ugly American is never wanted anywhere. But when you respect the culture, respect the people, the environment, and they see I do immediately, I think that's why they, you know, take us in so well and accept us. So, but, you know, I love playing Austria, Switzerland, Germany. I mean, I love, there's great crowds everywhere. You know, to me, one thing I noticed there in Europe, people have a little more, this is not putting down my beautiful people here in the United States, but they have a little more respect for when an artist is playing, they listen. They're not taking selfies. They're not, you know, trying to pick up girls and all that stuff. They do that during the break. They pay their money and they're going to hear the music and they're going to pay attention to you. And they're going to tell you, oh, you sang the wrong verse on that. And it's like, damn it. I did sing the wrong verse on that one. So, you know, they're really paying attention. And there's places like Nashville where they do the same. You know, you better go and pay attention or they'll kick you out. So, you know, that said, you know, people are people, man. It's like where people love you is where you want to be, you know, and where they don't, right. You know, you try harder or move on. So, you know, I just love it, man. I really enjoy meeting people and giving them a dose of what I do and hope they like it.
Dennis, your brand of the blues floats seamlessly between the classic blues and the more rock-infused blues, as you so desperately just noted a few minutes ago. But this gets a lot of discussion among blues aficionados. How do your audiences respond to the less traditional blues? Are they accepting of it? Do you get any resistance? How do they treat you?
Well, I think most people... I've been playing blues rock since my first album. It's not like I jumped on some bandwagon or tried to follow a trend. I've always been true to who I am as a songwriter and as an artist. So hopefully they know what they're about to see. And if they didn't like it, they shouldn't have paid the money for the ticket to come see me. But I do try my best, because a person in the crowd is always one person, not always, but normally somebody in the crowd, you can tell is not feeling it, doesn't like you for whatever reason. And I don't know why us musicians always try to win that person over. And they always have to sit in the front for some reason. I don't know what the logic about that is. But so I try. I've tried to win them over. And if I don't, then it's, so be it. I pay my attention to the other 99% of the people that are there that enjoy it. And so, yeah, I felt that before. I felt people that were like, oh, can't wait till this guy's off the stage. But, you know, there's people that are there that pay their money and they want to be entertained. They want to hear me at my best. So I block that person out and just continue to just go through it, man, and not worry about it. And really just try to put on a really good show every time. And you know, I hit people with some cover songs that they might know to get them in. And then I hit them with five or six of my songs. I mean, my original music is why I play this stuff. I played in cover bands before, but it's not my thing. I've quit several bands because they refused to do original music. I'm all about, you know, being as original as I can. So yeah, I found some resistance, but I just roll right over it and go to the next gig and try not to think about it.
Well, Dennis, 2020 and 2021 were decidedly tough couple of years for all of us. But I'd like to know how you processed this downtime. What did you do to keep yourself occupied? How did you handle the pandemic?
Well, like most of us, I ate and drank too much. And I was bummed the first couple of months because things were really starting to change for the band. A lot of festivals were coming in. I had shows with the Black Pumas. I had shows that were with Robert Cray. I had all kind of stuff coming up and it just, boom. I'm not, you know, sitting here playing my little violin because it happened to a lot of people. I'm not the only one. So I kind of regrouped after about 3 months. I regrouped and started on a new record. I recorded an album in 2020. Thought the pandemic would be over in a year. So I put it out and it did okay. But, you know, I didn't really get the tour on it. I think I did go to Europe January 2020. And so when we got back, I think March is when everything went to complete hell. But I really tried to just keep my head above water, write a bunch of songs, meditate, learn more about myself, you know, and what all this crazy life's about, and just continue, because I knew things were going to get better. I just didn't know when. But it was a tough period, but hey, man, it's life, you know?
So we need to wrap up here, but I wanted to ask you, where can our listeners and our viewers go to learn more about Dennis Jones? Maybe buy some CDs or vinyl, some merch, or book you for a gig.
Just go to my website, DennisJonesCentral.com, and everything's there. My tour schedule, you can download some stuff for free. You can buy the album physical, t-shirts, hats, anything you want right there on my website. It's right there. And before we go, I got to tell you about a really good experience I had a few months ago when I was in Mystique Island in the Caribbean. Joe Louis Walker invited me and several other musicians there. There's a festival they have, 2.5 weeks of musicians go there and play, and it's a charity. They make a lot of money for these kids in the neighboring islands. And I happened to meet on the last day, I met Mr. Mick Jagger. And
wow.
He was just incredible. I have a few pictures of him on my website, actually, DennisJonesCentral.com. And he was just a really, just amazing, you know. And I wasn't nervous. I just got off stage and Joe was like, hey, man, Mick Jagger's over there. Why don't you go say hi? I was like, cool. So I walk over, find him and take a couple pictures. And it's like, I don't want to take much of your time. But, you know, all the songs, man, the Stones to me are about songs and longevity and, you know, and after meeting Mick Jagger, it's like, Lord, it's like, he's the biggest rock star in the world. It's like, where am I going to go from here? So I just wanted to let the listeners know, and you know, that I had an amazing experience there. And I hope I get to go again. It was for a great charity. And I got a guy named Basil, who does all this, Basil Charles. And it was amazing. And I'm just looking forward to the future, man, to what else beautiful is going to happen, you know, and just, you know, treat people well. Hope they treat me well. I'm going out there with good intentions and to spread music, spread this blues music around the world.
Yes, sir. Well, Dennis Jones, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Time Signatures. Our very best wishes to you. And we genuinely look forward to seeing you perform locally sometime around here as well.
I'd love to. I'm working on adding new dates to my tour schedule almost every week now. And I'm from Baltimore originally, so I haven't been out there to tour in a few years. So when I cross the country, I definitely want to stop by. I hope I get to stop by where you are, and we'll stay in touch and try to make that happen.
We will absolutely do that. I've got some friends that have venues here in the state of Michigan, and we would definitely love to see you come through. That wraps up this edition of Time Signatures with Jim Irvin. I'm especially thankful to you, the listener and the viewer and the supporter, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you that keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.
Baby, I'm home.
Examining the issues and topics that affect our lives from the local level to the world stage. Listen to the programs of LCC Connect anytime at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect. Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Massage therapy can be an effective method to combat stress and anxiety. It can also be helpful for injury treatment and prevention. The Lansing Community College Massage Therapy Clinic is open to the public and provides the opportunity for students to learn. Visit lcc.edu/massage for more information.
Hi, I'm Lisa Alexander, and I host a show called Who's That Star on LCC Connect. This show is all about an inside look at the LCC community, where you get a chance to meet our faculty and staff, plus learn about their passion projects at work and at home. You can catch Who's That Star here on LCC Connect or listen anytime at lccconnect.org.
Hundreds of thousands of veterans have taken off their uniforms and put them away, carefully packed and safely stowed. But for some veterans, the uniform isn't so easily removed. The emotions experienced while serving continue to weigh on them. Life after service is different. Many veterans find transitioning difficult, and daily life is no longer as enjoyable as it once was. Some feel overwhelmed and lost. But that uncertainty doesn't take away from their strength and courage, nor does it take away from the sense of duty veterans carry with them. The transition from service is different for everyone. If you are a veteran going through a difficult time, or know one who is, the power of one person, one connection, one act of compassion can make a difference. For free 24/7 confidential support, call the Veterans Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1, or visit veteranscrisisline.net.
The Adult Enrichment Program at LCC offers classes in watercolor, creative welding, motorcycle safety, photography, and more. All classes are non-credit. Information about the Adult Enrichment Center is available at lcc.edu/keeplearning.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
This is Bob Myers from the Historical Society of Michigan with a Michigan History Moment. During World War I, Michigan sent 175,000 men into the United States Armed Forces. Of those, 5,000 died and 15,000 were wounded. Among the Michigan men fighting in the war to end all wars were Odawa from northern Michigan. The Great Lakes State's Native Americans had suffered countless injustices. They were not citizens, so they could not vote in national elections, hold federal government offices, or sue non-natives in court. They had no protection under the Bill of Rights. So why did Odawa men fight under the United States flag? The Odawa had continued to seek legal enforcement of their treaty rights. In 1905, their leaders sued the federal government to secure money owed them from the 1855 Treaty of Detroit. The Odawa won the lawsuit. Young men may have believed military service and subsequent citizenship would help further their tribe's efforts in the courts. Some young men undoubtedly enlisted for practical reasons. Economic opportunities for the Odawa were scarce, and military service offered a guaranteed income for the young men and their families. The Odawa also had a strong warrior tradition. In the late 17th century, Odawa warriors traveled east to fight the Iroquois in New York. Today, the U.S. Armed Forces have more Native Americans per capita in their ranks than that of any other ethnic group in the United States. Whatever their reasons for enlisting, Michigan's Odawa served with distinction in World War I. Pontiac Williams Jr., a 23-year-old Odawa from Hart, Michigan, was decorated for valor at Chateau Thierry in July 1918. Williams, a private in the 32nd Division, volunteered for an almost suicidal mission to bring in a wounded runner who lay in front of American lines. Williams succeeded despite being shot in the face, and he earned the Distinguished Service Cross. There is only one higher medal for valor, the Medal of Honor. Not all Odawa warriors returned home. Alex Kegabatang, son of an Odawa chief and a lineal descendant of Chief Pontiac, fell in battle in France, as did his relative, Thomas Kegabatang. Ironically, Alex's hometown of Cross Village burned to the ground on the same day he died. His family, however, remained there waiting for him to return. Only later did they learn that he would never come back. Alex Kagabatang was the first Native American killed in World War I. This Michigan History Moment was brought to you by MichiganHistoryMagazine.org.
Sharing the voices of Lansing Community College. Visit us at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Lansing Community College's dual enrollment program offers the opportunity for qualified high school students to earn college credit while working towards their high school diploma. Dual enrollment lets students receive educational advancement in areas where the student's interest is displayed, especially in courses and academic areas not available in the student's high school. To find out more information about dual enrollment, visit lcc.edu.
Wake up and text. Text and eat. Mm-mm. Text and meet up with a friend you haven't seen in forever.
Hi.
Oh, hey.
Text and complain that they're on their phone the whole time. Text and listen to them complain that you're on your phone the whole time. Text and whatever. But when you get behind the wheel, give your phone to a passenger. Put it in the glove box. Just don't text and drive. Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
The Job Training Center at Lansing Community College provides two-month job training opportunities that are free to eligible participants. Training courses range from information technology to administrative assisting. For more information, visit lcc.edu/JTC training.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
From Lansing Community College, this is LCC Connect, and this is Land Stories. With me, David Seawick. Each episode explores a different topic, such as the people, business, neighborhoods, communities, buildings, and other phenomena that make up the history of our college and our region. We tell stories, and in doing so, we connect the past to the present.
This episode of Land Stories will pick up where the prior episode, prior chronologically speaking, left off. And that would be in a place called Defiance, Ohio. And don't run away from your listening device just yet. This still is Land Stories, and we still talk about things related to the history of Michigan's capital region in and around Lansing. But we have to deviate sometimes to get a full picture of what we're talking about as it relates to the Lansing region. And this is one such episode, just like the past episode was, because we are actually talking about how a place called Meridian Township happened to get its name, the name Meridian, and the name Township, actually, because we are going to be talking about the establishment of the township system on this episode of Land Stories, because we are talking about the Great Michigan Land Survey and the reason why Meridian Township in the Michigan Capital Region is called so. And that is because of a survey line that was laid down many years ago, about 200 years ago or so, actually, that formed one of two survey lines that the entire state of Michigan would eventually be surveyed from. And that process was the Great Land Survey System that took place in Michigan and had a tremendous impact on the settlement of the state. The same is true of all the other parts of the United States that were surveyed under a similar system, and that is why it is worthy, even beyond the inquiry into why Meridian Township, Michigan is named so, to explore this very important moment in Michigan's past. Last episode, we talked about some broad conceptual ideas here that led to the land that we now call the state of Michigan being surveyed. And to summarize, if you have not had an episode or a moment to go back and listen to that episode, what we discussed was that way back when, mid-1700s, the situation in North America was changing quite a bit. The French and the British went to war, and that war, which we remember as the French and Indian War, or the Seven Years' War, it's called both, that resulted in the British acquiring lots of land, or at least claimant over a lot of land, in the middle of North America, including the land we now call Michigan. By the end of the 1700s, the American Revolution had happened. And the American Revolution resulted in many things, including the land of Michigan becoming part of that new country called the United States of America. And so Michigan then is part of that new country, and there are many other lands that have been brought into the newly formed republic. The leaders of that newly formed republic determined they wanted to settle, and that meant having people move on to it. And the mindset that people were operating under at the time was not all that different than the mindset that people operate under nowadays when it comes to using land. And land at that time was looked at as something that you really could not survive without having. In other words, you nowadays can take a look at the economy here in a place called, or a place like Michigan, and we can see there are a lot of ways that people can make a living. And very few people who live in Michigan right now actually make their living off the physical property that they own. Most people go to work in a job that is related eventually to the economic activity that takes place on large tracts of land, but it's indirectly related. We go back in time to 200 years ago in the early 1800s when people were setting their eyes on the land of Michigan to settle it. People did not think you could really make a living unless you had land to farm. It was an agrarian economy by and large at the time, and so when people wanted to set places to live, they had to have land. And so when Michigan becomes part of the United States, Congress immediately sets forth a directive to foster settlement into Michigan and settlement in all kinds of other areas of the middle, what we now know is the middle part of the United States, but what at the time was actually called the Northwest. So by the time we get to the establishment of the Michigan Territory, which happens in 1805, actually the 11th of January of 1805 is when Congress created the Michigan Territory. That's when the legislation went into effect that established the Michigan Territory. And at that point in the early 1800s, Congress had already passed laws in the decades prior that made it easier for people to move on to the land, because those laws that were passed set forth the process by which that land could be surveyed and then eventually sold to settlers who would come into Michigan from areas mostly further east and south, in some places way, way, way away, even on the other side of the ocean, and they would become the pioneering generation of Michigan. So that is a bit of a summary of what we discussed in the last episode, and that gets us to that point where it is time to survey the lands of Michigan. We left off the last episode where we are right now, actually, and we are, believe it or not, at least in our minds we should be, we are in Defiance, Ohio. Defiance, Ohio isn't in Michigan, of course. It's actually a few miles south of the Michigan-Ohio border, but Defiance, Ohio is roughly a perfectly straight line south of Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. And when the Michigan Land Survey started, surveyors had to establish a point where the land could be surveyed out with, and that point became the location of the starting point of Michigan's Land Survey. In order to determine where this point was, people at the time got maps out, and they said, okay, we're going to have to draw two lines. One is going to go from the north to the south. The other is going to go from either the west to the east or the east to the west. And where those two points meet, we are going to create a grid from those two points. And when the Northwest Territory was created, out of all the lands that the United States acquired from Britain in the Great Lakes and Ohio Valley regions of North America as a result of the Revolutionary War, Congress created the Northwest Territory to determine what would happen with all those lands. And out of the Northwest Territory, we get the means by which a territory would be organized and eventually admitted into the Union as a state. So out of that, enacting legislation, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 creates the Northwest Territory, and as had been the overarching design of that ordinance, Eventually, smaller territories that became states of their own are carved out of that territory. Ohio was the first such political unit to emerge from the Northwest Territory, and it was, I almost said it was admitted into the Union as a state in 1805, but that's not exactly true. Yes, Ohio was admitted into the Union as a state. Well, Ohio became a state. You see, there's a little bit of a dispute over whether or not Ohio was ever actually admitted into the Union as a state in the early 1800s, because nobody could actually find enacting legislation that Congress passed that declared and determined the territory of Ohio to be a state. This is something that Congress had done with other territories that were admitted into the Union as a state, including Michigan, by the way, which was admitted into the Union in 1837. And Andrew Jackson was the president of the United States when that happened. So that little side note of history aside, by the way, people do not nowadays accuse Ohio of not being a proper state. But just to make sure, in the 20th century, Congress did formally admit Ohio into the Union as more of a ceremonial gesture than anything. And hey, if this was an episode of Columbus Stories and we were talking all about the history of Ohio and the capital city of Ohio, which is Columbus, we would talk more about that. But guess what? It's not. We had to dip our toes down into the territory of Ohio for a few moments because we have to get to Defiance, Ohio. But beyond that, we're not going to talk about Ohio much. We do need to know, though, the establishment of the Ohio Territory and eventually the carving of the state of Ohio out of that Northwest Territory is the process that we want to focus on, because that's the process that all of the territories and states that emerged from the Northwest Territory would also follow. So the Great Land Survey System that became known as the Boustro-Fedonical, say that a few times, Boustro-Fedonical, Boustro-Fedonical. The Boustro-Fedonical Section Number System, and by the way, that word is spelled Boustro-Phedonical, and yes, I did look at that written down on a piece of paper before I recited that spelling to you, but the Boustro-Fedonical Section Numbering System is the public land survey system and the system of local government that emerges from this great survey that we've been talking about on this episode of Land Stories and the prior one chronologically in the order that the episodes have been released. And what this section number system did is it determined that the way all the lands would be surveyed out of the territory of the Northwest would be to establish grids and from there survey the entire area in square mile units, with the intent that several square mile units would be gathered to form townships. And that township system would be the basis by which all units of local government, or at least most of them, would eventually be established in the territories out of the Northwest that eventually became states. So in Ohio, in Indiana, in Illinois, in Michigan, and in Wisconsin, those are the territories that became states out of the Northwest, and all of those territories eventually followed the same survey system that started in Ohio. That's the Boustro-Fedonical Section Number System. It happens to do with both surveying and governance. So let's take a quick step back and look at those two terms, survey and governance, and see how they relate to all of the land in Michigan being divided up so people could buy it and settle onto it. And as we do so, the word meridian is going to enter into this picture, actually, as are some of the other general concepts and their very specific applications historically to people settling into Michigan. So first, survey. To survey land is to literally determine what exists on it, where it exists, and how big it is. So land surveying has been around probably as long as people have built things. One can study ancient structures around the world and learn a bit about how they were constructed by studying them, and determine that most buildings, when they're built, well, there was a site survey that was done because people need to figure out where the building they're going to build goes. When you look at surveying a very large area of land, conceptually, it's sort of the same thing going on. People are looking at a large area of land and they're trying to get a sense of what that land looks like because they want to do something with it. In the early 1800s, when Michigan's land was being surveyed, that thing that most people wanted to do with it, keep in mind, was either farming or taking the stuff that was already on the land off of it because it could be used for something. So in Michigan, that stuff that was on the land was trees. And some of the earliest activity that took place in Michigan related to land surveying was actually for people looking for lumber. But more than that, much more than that, the land surveying in Michigan was done with the intent that people would eventually move on to land and farm it. And the whole concept of homesteading and of people setting up for themselves a farm that could be both an independently run family business and also something that would support the family, this is a concept that really starts at this time period. It's a very important part of the entire founding ideology of the middle part of the United States, and that would certainly include Michigan. I mention it here because that second aspect that we want to consider beyond surveying is the governance aspect. And this is where the township system comes into play here. And we're back to the Brostow-Fedonickel section numbering system because once land surveyors started their grid, they then, as I mentioned a few moments ago, surveyed all the land in the cardinal directions that emanate from that cross point that the survey started in square mile increments. Those square mile increments would be grouped into groups of six, and that would form the local government unit that really the entire middle part of the United States would eventually be organized around. And it's the unit of the township. So in Michigan and in most other territories and states that came out of the Northwest Territory, the Brostow-Fedonickel section numbering system looked like this. It was 6 miles square, and it still is, by the way, which means most townships are 6 miles from north to south and 6 miles from east to west. Those mile increments were determined during the land survey of the Brostow-Fedonickel section numbering system that starts in the eastern part of Ohio in the very late 1700s. And eventually moves westward as settlers and interest moved westward as well. So in Michigan, then, the Great Land Survey really doesn't start until after the War of 1812. The War of 1812 is the reason for this. So with the Brostow-Fedonickel section numbering system established and the Great Land Survey, the middle part of the country underway, Ohio is surveyed, and then the War of 1812 breaks out. This delays further movement into the middle part of the country, but the War of 1812 ends. Congress, before the War of 1812, as I mentioned towards the beginning of our episode today, had already created the Michigan Territory. And so once the War of 1812 ends, there is a renewed interest in settling into those parts of the country, including Michigan, that have been impacted by the war. So in 1815, finally, the survey of Michigan starts. And from Defiance, Ohio, is where the land surveyors embarked on their great journey, their great effort to survey Michigan. As I mentioned towards the beginning of the episode, Defiance, Ohio is important because the land survey had to be done both conceptually and in a very real sense. In other words, a map, if you look at a map is a concept. It's an idea. It's representing something that is very real. So when you look at a map, you're not actually looking at the area of land that the map depicts, but the map is very important for you to be able to determine where you are going on the area of land that the map depicts. So it turns into a question of process. If somebody wants to survey an area, they have to establish a survey grid. How is that survey grid going to be established? Well, one needs a map to establish a survey grid. And there were maps that existed of the Great Lakes and Ohio Valley regions of North America when this Great Land Survey commenced. Those maps weren't super accurate. The land surveyors would make them accurate because they eventually were to walk and physically be on all of the land that they surveyed. So using, albeit inaccurate maps, nonetheless, using maps is actually how the land surveyors would start. The maps they had gave them a general idea of where they were. And from that point on, they had to determine where their survey was going to start. In Michigan, Sault Ste. Marie was a town that already existed. Before the War of 1812, Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and what we now know as Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, were one town. The border between what is now the United States and Canada was very difficult to determine until good land surveys had been completed. And they certainly had not been completed yet. In the early part of the 1800s, or even into the later 1700s as well. And so that's why determining even where the American and British Canadian border was in the early decades of the country's existence was a far more difficult process than one might imagine. And for that reason, where people lived, they sometimes weren't necessarily concerned with what the political developments hundreds of miles away had determined a boundary might exist where it hadn't before. And that is really what happened with Sault Ste. Marie. Sault Ste. Marie was settled way back in the 1600s by the French. It's actually one of the oldest towns anywhere in the United States that has a European or Euro-American establishment origin to it. And Sault Ste. Marie was one town on both sides of the St. Mary's River until after the War of 1812. The War of 1812 was fought, amongst other things, over a dispute between the American and British-Canadian border. So after the War of 1812 ended, one of the things that the sides who fought, that would be the British and the Americans, determined they needed to do to keep the peace was determine where the border was located. And when that determination happened, the St. Mary's River became the agreed-upon point where the American and Canadian border would exist at the end of Lake Superior. So, the St. Mary's River, by the way, is what flows out of Lake Superior, and it connects Lake Superior to Lake Huron. That is where Sault Ste. Marie was located. The St. Mary's River, therefore, became the border between the United States and Canada, and it still is. There's a bridge that connects Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario. However, that bridge was not completed until 1959. And from the end of the War of 1812 until the middle part of the 20th century, the division of those two communities from the political division after the War of 1812 was a very physical division because there was no bridge connecting the two of them. But now there is. So, with that little bit of diversion established, we know that Sault Ste. Marie existed. And so Sault Ste. Marie was one town that people knew where it existed. And that, more than anything, is why it was chosen as the northern terminus point for the survey line that would become known as the Meridian Line. So, if one gets a map out and draws a line straight south from Sault Ste. Marie, it eventually ends up in Defiance, Ohio. And that, therefore, is why the Land Survey of Michigan started from there, because that is how they established the Michigan Meridian. It is a line that goes from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, to Defiance, Ohio. So, when the Great Michigan Survey started, a surveyor by the name of Benjamin Hoe was hired to do the initial work of determining where that meridian line would meet a baseline, which was the horizontal line that would be drawn on a map, surveyed in a very physical sense by walking it on the ground, and then from that point on, that meridian and baseline juncture is where the survey was to take place. And that is kind of what happened, but there is an interesting twist to the story here. So nowadays, one can drive down Meridian Road in Ingham County, Michigan, And for some of the stretch of that road, one is driving right along that original Michigan Meridian Survey line. That is, after all, why that road is called Meridian Road, and it's why Meridian Township is named Meridian Township. And tangentially, that's why the Meridian Mall is called the Meridian Mall. Anything you see with the word Meridian on it, or hear with the word Meridian on it, in the Michigan Capital Region is because of the Meridian Survey Line. So once that Meridian Line is established, the baseline comes into existence through the process I just described, and one would think, hey, this is great. We've got a nice precise point, A as in 1 point. I emphasize that for a reason, because one would think that was the case, but actually it wasn't. Here's why. When Benjamin Ho walked the land and made his initial marks, he did not make his marks very accurately. And at the same time, he got interrupted because he had to do another job, and so he was pulled off the project and did not complete his mapping of where that initial baseline would take place. So another land surveyor by the name of Fletcher took over. When he attempted to find Hull's line, he found it, but for reasons we are still not able to determine, he made inaccurate measurements, and he actually ended up demarcating a baseline that was several hundred feet. It was about 800 feet south of Hull's line. Later on, another land surveyor was brought in to try to correct this discrepancy. His name is Joseph Wampler, and what Wampler ended up doing was he determined where the Hull line was, he determined where the Fletcher line was located, and he said, okay, these lines are a few hundred feet away from one another. What we'll do is we will survey from both points. And so Michigan's land survey was exactly done by that. It was surveyed from two different points that are slightly off from one another, which really is quite remarkable to think about. And all of these years later, you yourself can actually see what this physically looks like, because the state of Michigan has marked on the land, well, it's very much the border of Jackson and Ingham County. There's a few acres of land that the state acquired through the years that was on private property that surround where these original land survey marks were laid down at the points at which the base and meridian lines meet. That area of land, again, the state of Michigan acquired enough land around it a few years ago that they were able to establish a state park there, and it is called the Meridian Baseline Survey Point Park. Sometime go there and check it out, and in doing so, you will be at really the point at which Michigan in many ways began. Last thing I'll say about this is, if you own property, sometime take out your property deed. Look at the survey marks that are on that property deed. Whether you realize or not, all of those survey marks make reference back to original lines that were drawn on maps 200 years ago that are all part of that Bostrophedonical survey system. So, this episode of Land Stories will not end in Defiance, Ohio, even though that's where it began. It'll end in Lansing.
You've been listening to Land Stories with me, David Seawick. For more information on this program and to stream past episodes, visit lccconnect.org. LCC Connect is the official home of the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College, offering hours of original and exciting programming. Hosted by faculty, staff, and community members, LCC Connect explores our college's work in the community, important topics in higher education, and our vision for the future. Catch the vibe on 89.7 FM or online at lccconnect.org. Until next time, remember, keep telling good stories.
This has been a presentation of LCC Connect, a weekly program that features the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College. All shows featured on LCC Connect are recorded at the WLNZ studio, located on LCC's downtown campus. Each program is podcast-based and can be heard anytime at lccconnect.org.
If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on one of our shows, connect with us by emailing lcc-connect@lcc.edu.